Welcome to Tulsa Talks, presented by Tulsa Regional Chamber. I'm your host, Tim Landis. I'm really excited to share this conversation with you. For over 50 years, Bell's Amusement Park was the spot for fun for many Oklahoma kids, including myself. Growing up in Claremore, the trips to Bell's were among the biggest highlights of my summer for many summers. There was the Zingo and the Wildcat, the Himalaya and the Phantasmagoria, the Log Ride and the Arcade, and so much more. The story of Bell's Amusement Park is an example of the classic American dream. A family builds a business, the people come, and the business grows. It's also a story of fathers and sons, which is perfect for this week as we celebrate the fathers in our lives on Father's Day. I sat down with Bob and Robbie Bell on a recent Saturday morning, and they recounted the history of the park and their family's story that spans over 100 years in Tulsa. We start this conversation with Bob, who is now 80, reflecting on how Bell's came to be and his many roles in helping his father's dream become a reality. Bob's father, Robert Kiwanis Bell, opened a kiddie park post-World War II with the help of his young son. Bob grew up and took over operations as he raised his own family in the business. Robbie, 55, chimes in from time to time to help his father share their story, and then he shares his own story about what it was like to be the next generation of the Bell's family to help his father run the park before taking it over. Did you know the Bell's founders lived in an apartment in the middle of Zingo? It was amazing to sit with both of them as they recounted the long, unique history of the family business and what it was like to be sons and then fathers of Bell's employees. There were a whole lot of laughs and some tears. It's been 14 years since Bell's closed. It remains a sensitive subject for the Bell family. Bob and Robbie discuss what happened in 2006 that forced them to shut down the park and how it brought them even closer as family. They also discuss their plans to open a new Bell's in the near future. They've heard your angst and complaints about it taking too long. They explain why the wait has been so long and how it will hopefully be over soon. More on that later. This episode is broken down into three sections. The origin of Bell's is the first 25 minutes. Bob and Robbie's time at the park is the second part. And at about the 50-minute mark is the third part, which covers the closure and the future. Bell's Amusement Park played an important role in our city and county's history. It created lifelong memories for lots of people. I'm thrilled to share Bob and Robbie's story with you. As you'll hear, they are two characters who are far from finished having a fun time together. Let's get this going. This is Tulsa Talks with Bob and Robbie Bell. Welcome to Tulsa Talks. I think maybe should I start with, do you want to go faster? Because that is a line that I will forever remember for this family. I've got Bob and Robbie Bell here from Bell's Amusement Park. It is a staple of Tulsa history. And Bob Bell and I, we were just chatting. He was telling me about their family history. And it turns out that the Bell family started in Tulsa in 1918 when Albert Bell, an attorney, he moved here from Ohio chasing the oil business, became a businessman here, pretty prominent, helped get TU here, has his son, and then in 1940, Bob's born. So America's headed to war, Bob's born in Tulsa, they're building planes and everything to kind of set the stage of what it was like then.
Well, the way Bell's initially got started on Christmas of 46, my dad made me what was called then a little midget racer with a Maytag washing machine motor in it. And, of course, that was quite a feature right after the Second World War. And, of course, no one had especially somebody who was 6 years old, had anything like that. The people envision go-karts now, but this is way before go-karts. And so I had this little midget racer, and our next door neighbor said, Bob, talking to my dad, said, we can build one of these small trains, and we can pick up some extra money on the weekends. And my dad said, yeah, let's do that, because my dad could do just about anything. Anyway, that's what we did. And we built a little miniature train that ran around our house near 8th and Lewis. The house is still there. And the garage is still there where we built all this stuff. And we ended up building about 3 rides in that garage. And it was the basis of that after about 4 or 5 years, they dissolved that partnership. But my dad went on, and we built other things. You brought up the airplane business. Well, we made a little airplane ride that went around in a circle and resembled a F-86 fighter jet, and that was used in Korea. But anyway, they had drop tanks, and we used those drop tanks as the fuselage for this little train ride, I mean this little plane ride, that went around in a circle, and the kids loved it. And it resembled, the Sabre jet.
So what was your dad like? I mean,
he was the entrepreneur of entrepreneurs. He did so many things. The first thing I remember was he built a boat in the backyard. And they put a big motor in it, and they took it out to Lake Yohola, out where Mohawk Park is. And he almost got killed by that boat. But just like every entrepreneur, he always overdoes things. And he put in too big a motor, and it didn't ride correctly through the water. It had the bow up too high, and the boat ended up trying to run over him and 3 other guys. Anyway, yeah, and he made candles. He made these snowball-type Christmas balls that were candles. Oh, it was a fascinating thing. He even bought a record machine that would cut records, actually cut the disc of vinyl or whatever that stuff is called, and made recordings. And I used to have recordings of my birthday parties.
Oh, wow.
And like, I'm Susie, and I got Bobby a little such and such, thing.
Yeah.
And we saved all that for many years. And my dad did lots of different things. He was just exciting to be around.
But your dad was only around, 30 or so when he opens Bell's as we know it?
Yeah, he was 33.
33.
And I was, I had just turned 11. And but we built a merry-go-round that was... In Christmas of 1950, was in the downtown Brown Duncan's department store. Okay. That's the first I ever heard of a merry-go-round being in any department store anywhere.
Wow. So what made him decide to do Bell's?
Well, it was just a natural. I mean, he went to Crystal City Amusement Park, which is located where Crystal City is now, and he just remembered they had a roller coaster there that was called the Zingo Cannonball. And that's where we got the name that we used later on in 1968, Zingo the roller coaster.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. So there's ties to even the name there. So.
Well, there were 3 wooden roller coasters in the Tulsa area. Tulsa, Sand Springs, and that Crystal City area.
So when Bell's was opened in its location at the fairgrounds in that area, it was rural, kind of just south of that, right? It was,
yes,
you're kind of out in the country.
Yes. All right. Now where the Golden Driller is, everybody knows the Golden Driller. Well, there was a prairie area just immediately across 21st Street from the Golden Driller. Glenn Dobbs, who later became athletic director out at TU. Glenn Dobbs had a driving range there where all those houses are now. He had a driving range. And so in 1950, this is a year before Bell's existed, in 1950, we had 3 rides at that driving range, a little train, one of the trains that we manufactured. We made several trains. And then there was a little car ride that's made out of pedal cars, and there was a dozen of them in a circle, went around and around. And then we also built a Ferris wheel. And the Ferris wheel was set up, like I said before, it was made in our backyard. And we built it all right there near 8th and Lewis.
What got you across the street?
Pardon me?
What got you across the street to the fairgrounds?
Oh, well, my dad had approached the fairgrounds in 1950, and they did not want a permanent kiddie park, whatever you want to call it, on the fairgrounds. And so my dad got this proposal from Glenn Dobbs to set up at his driving range, which is right across the street from the fairgrounds. So that's where we ended up. Well, it was such a success that they opened it up for bid to put a park for the season of 1951. And my dad won the bid. And we paid 30% of our gross as rent.
So that year you moved across the street.
Yeah, okay. 1951.
And then that is Bell's Amusement Park as we know it, the creation of it.
Yeah, we had a little sign that said Bell's, you know. And,
yeah.
And it was all very simple. It wasn't crude, but it was borderline crude. But it was just, you know, a simple entrepreneur just trying to have fun and make money.
Yeah. So you grow up in this post-World War II. You're a kid when your dad's building these race cars and stuff. America's not at war then. And then when you open Bell's, we're in the Korean War at the time. Kind of go back to your memories of what Tulsa was like, what it was like being a kid, watching your dad open an amusement park in that time period.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was right there with him.
Yeah.
I mean, I operated a drill press in 1947, and I drilled these little bitty holes that you put cotter pins in, you know, that it fastens the rides together. And I remember I stood on a milk crate because I was too short to reach the drill press handle. But anyway, and then another thing I remember was all the sanding that we did by hand on these trains. You know, there was a lot of body work, and I just remember my forearms being sore all the time. But at the same time, there was a lot of work, but it was a lot of status because my contemporaries, they didn't do anything like that.
No.
You know, they were just getting into mowing lawns, and there I was involved in welding and things like that. And it was a tremendous amount of status for a little kid. So it was that's what I remember, all the different things that we made, like that little train, that little plane that I spoke of earlier, was made. We assembled the first one in the basement. And then we discovered that we couldn't get it through the door, so we had to dismantle it. But anyway, you know, there's so many. That's the wonderful thing about being an entrepreneur, is that, and being around entrepreneurs, you know, that spirit, they're just exciting people, and they make things happen. They may be very elementary and crude in the beginning, but they want to risk. And it's to everybody's betterment that we have that sort of spirit that's available to help us build all sorts of different communities. So it was a very exciting time for me.
Tim, this is Robbie. Let me jump in here real quick.
Yeah.
I want to prompt my dad, because since this is not just about the park, but about father and son relationship.
Right.
Okay, Daddy, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to tell Tim what happened when it came time to make one of your first really big purchases, the merry-go-round. Tell Tim that story.
Well, we already had a merry-go-round in existence. It was a very simple one. It had 16 horses on it. And that's one that we had in the downtown department store at Brown Duncan's. Well, my dad had a chance to buy this really nice merry-go-round that had 30 horses. And so we thought, wow, let's do that. And this is 1954.
So you're 14.
I'm 14 years old. Yeah, and my dad, even though he worked me a whole bunch, my dad paid me money. I never received an allowance. My dad paid me for everything that I did, whether it was mowing the lawn or trimming the hedge or sanding on the train or bolting the airplanes together, or whatever it was. My dad paid me, and it was a very nominal fee, but I didn't spend my money on anything. And by the time I was 14, I had $450.
Wow. It's 1954.
Right. Yeah, it'd be like several thousand right now.
Yeah, it's couple thousand for a car, I think, at that time.
Yeah. Well, see, that's what I was saving for. I'm 14. I'm going to have a car when I'm 16. You know. But anyway, my dad had this chance to buy this merry-go-round that was in the Los Angeles area. Well, the freight for that merry-go-round from L.A. to Tulsa was $450. And my dad was mortgaged to the hilt, spent all of his money on investing in the park. At the same time, he was also working at the post office as a postal clerk.
Okay.
He had a full-time 40-hour job, plus he was building all these rides.
Wow.
It was phenomenal. Anyway, with this $450, he said, he came to me. He called me Rasp. That was my nickname, Rasp, R-A-S-P. And Rasp, I'm needing that $450. Would you be interested in investing in the freight to bring that merry-go-round here?
Okay, so he had enough money to buy the merry-go-round.
Yeah.
But he didn't have enough money to get it to Tulsa.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, good.
He didn't have the money to get it to Tulsa. Okay. The ride was like $4,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was flabbergasted. I totally trusted my dad, but the thing that really got me is that he asked me, and he had already paid me this money. I didn't have any money except for him, but he asked me for that money, and he showed me such respect, I was just bowled over. There was no way I was going to say no.
Wow.
And so we used that money, and we got that merry-go-round. In fact, we still have that merry-go-round stashed someplace. That's the only merry-go-round we had at the park from 1954 until we closed in 2006.
Man, so that's when you become a business partner in the amusement park, basically.
Yeah, I was
outside 14. Outside of being child skilled labor. Building things.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard of an 8-year-old welding, so I think you're probably...
was 9.
9, okay, well, 9.
And I worked a drill press when I was 7.
There you go. So,
and he wouldn't let me spray paint till I was 12.
Why?
Because paint was real expensive. And if you painted it wrong, you get a run, and then, boy, you really messed up.
You had to sand it down again.
It wasn't until I was 12 that he let me paint, spray paint.
So the park opens. What was it like working with your dad and seeing all these kids your age having fun, and you're there to make sure that they're enjoying their time? I mean, what was that like for you? I mean, there's you and your dad operating this amusement park.
The hours were long. My buddies were always prodding me, to go someplace, and I couldn't. I had to work, but it worked out. Really well for me. There was a lot of pretty girls that were at the park. And I remember several of them. Anyway, be careful.
Some of them might be listening.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're all around 80 years old.
Still, that doesn't mean you can't get in trouble.
But anyway, it was still, even though it was hard work, it was a lot of status. What I found out later was that, I was paid very nominally, but I was paid for the work I did. A lot of my friends, I found out later, some of them who had to work because they needed for the family's income, they weren't able to keep their money. They put it into the family till. So I was super fortunate that I had such a generous father. He just, he worked me like a man, but he treated me like a man. He treated me with respect, and it really made the hard work very tolerable, because I knew that I was with somebody who was really special. My dad was unreal special. He was very unique. Besides being an entrepreneur, he was just a visionary, and he just had that drive that makes things happen. You need someone who will really push the envelope, and he was one of those guys.
The park gets going. When do you start to take over the park? Like, around what time did you take over the operations from your dad? Did he finally trust you to?
Early on, I was very involved in the maintenance, and I was the steeplejack. I don't know if you know what a steeplejack is. That's the guy who's the climber who does all the really high work.
Okay.
I was never afraid of heights, and so that worked out really great. And I was also very fit. And
we're talking about how you eventually it evolves to where you're in charge.
Oh yeah, you know, yeah. But I never really got into the managerial part of it. It was mostly focused on the maintenance until about. About the time that we built the roller coaster. And by then...
1968.
Yeah, 1968.
Let me interject just a little bit here, Tim. Part of what happened is the park goes from a small operation to bigger and bigger. But then when the coaster was added, it really exploded. So that... required my dad to do more than just, he had to help run the thing with my grandfather because it became so big.
Yeah.
And all this growth and more people, more money, more headache, more everything. And so the old man, that's what we always called him, you know, my dad had to help him with that.
Yeah.
You know. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, when we built the roller coaster, we had the existing park, which was a very successful park. But when we built the roller coaster, we finished it in 1968, that first season, the rest of the park doubled in revenue. Just the addition of that one ride made the whole thing much bigger. So we had a tremendous growth. And then from that roller coaster, the Zingo, from that, we went into Phantasmagoria, the Himalaya ride, and then all the other more thrilling rides. One thing I want to make sure, my dad got in trouble when we were building Zingo because he put Robbie, who was 2.5 years old, on his shoulders, and he walked up to the top of the roller coaster. The roller coaster wasn't finished yet, but the first incline was.
The chain hill.
The chain hill. And so and my wife found out about it because I took a picture of my dad with Robbie on his shoulders, and Robbie's only 2.5. And of course,
about 70 feet in the air.
Yeah, 70 feet in the air, 76 feet in the air, yeah.
On an unfinished roller coaster.
Needless to say, Tim, I don't have an aversion to heights either. I kind of learned it at an early age. Yeah.
Tulsa Talks listeners, we love Tulsa, and we know you do too. So does the Tulsa Regional Chamber. You might not realize it, but the Chamber is more than 100 years old, which more than makes it a Tulsa institution. They represent 2,000 member organizations and more than 175,000 area workers. As a business-driven leadership organization, their goal is to improve the quality of community life through the development of regional economic prosperity. What does that mean? It means their staff of 75 works hard every single day to attract, retain, and expand great businesses. They work to increase educational access and workforce skill levels. They advocate on behalf of their members at both the state and federal levels. They champion efforts to make our community more inviting and livable. And they promote our region as a vibrant tourist destination. To learn more about all that the Chamber does and to become a member, visit TulsaChamber.com.
Do you remember the prices of what things cost at that time?
Well, yes, especially with the roller. Well, the first
go
year
to the beginning.
Yeah, in the beginning, The rides were 9 cents each, or 3 for a quarter.
Okay.
But and these were all small kiddie rides. We operated at the fairgrounds for the first time. We went from 3 rides to 7 rides in that 1951 first season. And the prices were 9 cents each, or 3 for a quarter. A real bargain.
Now, and then tell them the pricing on Zingo. 1968?
Yeah. You know. All right. And then, yeah, the as inflation grew, of course, we grew with the prices. Zingo was the only wooden roller coaster made in the entire world in 1968.
In that year.
Okay.
Yeah, in 1968. It was the only one that was being built. And we knew it was going to really be something. And there was not another really spectacular roller coaster like that anywhere in the area.
Mm-hmm.
All right. When we built that thing, the price.
Yeah.
It was the most expensive roller coaster. Roller coaster rides back then were around 50 cents for a ride. And this one was 75 cents. And everybody thought we were nuts for charging that much money. 75 cents a ride.
Cents.
Yeah. So.
You have Zingo built and running, so that means that Robbie is around because he was
three.
Yeah, he was up there at the top before it was finished.
Right.
So you have kids, you're running this park. What was it like being a father instead of a son that, you know, you made that switch and you're running the park at the same time?
I kind of have regrets about it because I just worked all the time. We never went to the lake. I think in his early years, we probably only went to the lake one time until he was a teenager.
Yeah.
We just worked at the park all the time. So I still have a little bit of guilt not having more of a family life. Our family life was the business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens a lot with family-owned businesses. That becomes the existence for the whole family. But on the other side of that, Robbie, I'm sure, enjoyed the status of being, golly, your dad owns an amusement park, you know, wow, what a deal, you know. In fact, we even made an apartment for my folks, and they lived there at the park. It was kind of underneath the roller coaster. It was an office/apartment for my parents.
Wow.
And they moved out of their house because, you know, it was just the two of them. So they were more comfortable living inside, you know, the roller coaster area. And we always called it underneath the roller coaster. It really wasn't underneath the roller coaster, but it was in the middle of the roller coaster.
It looked like a maintenance shop.
Right.
On the outside. It was corrugated metal.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture.
But no windows. And it had doors, obviously, to get in and out of. Now, the inside was very nice. But the outside, it looked like a mini storage/maintenance shop. That's what it looked like.
Yeah, it had a wood-burning fireplace.
And we called it the apartment.
So your parents lived there?
Yeah.
For about seven years.
Yeah. I think, did they move out there in 1971, Daddy? Is that what you remember?
Yeah, it was mostly from 71, 72.
So how did your mom handle the clinking of Zingo all day long if she's living in the middle of it? Because that thing
that's
had to...
That's kind of like the register ringing.
Yeah, you just tone it out after
okay,
a while?
Okay, I
know, that's money.
Oh, I see.
Okay, Tim, I got to say this, because after all, it's father-son. So I've got my oldest, Bobby. He's about 8 years old.
Yeah.
And we're out at the park. The park's going like crazy. There's lots of people there. But, you know, Zingo... When any roller coaster goes over a hill, you hear this clank, 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 clank. Okay, those are what are called anti-rollback devices. And mm-hmm. So for some reason, the car gets stuck, it doesn't go back down the hill.
Yeah.
And that's what you're hearing. But it does make this noise. And so it was making that noise, and I grabbed Bobby. I said, Bobby, you know what that is, that sound? He said, yeah, Daddy, that's Zingo. I said, no, that's money.
That's right. That's money.
Well, and besides, my grandmother was never in the apartment when the park was open because
she was working.
Do you bet?
I guess that's true.
Yeah, I mean, same thing with my mom. All of us. I mean, it's a family adventure to say the least. Everybody's involved.
Wow. So now you've got Robbie there at the park with you as a kid. I mean, what was it like for you two to be, for you to be, did you know that you were basically doing what your dad did?
No, I didn't, because my experience was so different from my father's. Okay. But in many ways it was the same. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
When we purchased the Himalaya, that was 1973, so that makes me 8 years old, and I was enthralled with this ride. And so I'll back up just a little bit. The very first thing that I can remember ever doing for my dad, I was about 5, because 1970, and there were a set of restrooms, a lot of people remember this, right at the exit of the roller coaster, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, what would be the western wall of this building is not seen by the public because it's right next to where the brakes are for Zingo. Okay, so there's a wall, nobody but maintenance people would ever look at this wall. And so I would go to work with my dad at 4 or 5 years old, and I wanted to do something. And so he gave me paintbrush and paint and roller and all that stuff, and he let me paint this wall that nobody would ever see. And as the story goes, I got more paint in my shoes than I did on the wall. But anyway, so in 73, when we put the Himalaya in, I was fascinated with that. And so I would ask if I could go and take tickets, because at that time, we're still just doing tickets. There are no wristbands. There's no pay one price. It's what you call pay as you go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I would do that every now and then. But my parents ran a pretty strict household. As far as rules and stuff, okay, and so I didn't get to stay out real late, you know, but they let me do a little bit of stuff, and they let me work with certain people at the park that they trusted, right? Because now it's a completely different deal. The park is very big now, and it generates a lot of money, so it's not like I could have the same experience with my dad working side by side,
right?
Because he was busy doing big time stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at this time, my grandfather is still alive. Well, he dies in 1980. We can talk about that in a minute. But anyway, so from the time I'm about 8 until I'm about 12, I would do little odd jobs every now and then. And then I'm 12, it's 1977, and he puts me on the payroll, pays me a penny a minute, 60 cents an hour.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's where kind of repeats itself. My dad would always pay me for what I did. I never received an allowance, but whenever I worked, I got paid. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that's a heck of an advantage for a teenager. When your buddies, if you want to go see the Kiss concert, and your buddies have got to go ask their parents for the money for the ticket. I didn't have to do that. Now, I had to ask them permission to go, but I had my own money to buy my own ticket. And if I wanted to go out and get the latest record, you know, the latest Elton John record or whatever, I just went to the record store and bought it because I had my own money. And so there was obviously some differences because the park was there. But then there were a lot of similarities. He taught me how to weld when I was about 12. By the time I was 16... we had a pretty sophisticated paint operation, and I could paint an automobile quality paint job, but by that time, you know, with what they call HVLP type of painting and stuff like that, and learned a lot of the maintenance stuff. But I kind of got pushed more towards the managerial side of things, which probably was the best thing. I'm not as skilled as my father is from the mechanical side. And my skills were probably better used on the managerial side. So by the time I'm 17, I have a small army of employees underneath me. I was supervising about half of the Midway. What we did is we divided the park, from a managerial standpoint, we divided the park in half. Bell's really was kind of a rectangle, basically, in shape. And it ran north and south. And so someone had the south end and someone had the north end. And but he was always right there. But I always say, besides my life, the greatest gift my father ever gave me was the ability to fail. Okay? We all make mistakes. What's bad is when you make a mistake and you don't learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you make a mistake and you learn from it, it's a good thing. You know, it improves your life. It improves the way you are about everything, right? And so he gave me enough rope to hang myself. Yeah, okay. and learn some tough lessons. But as a result, it made me more experienced and hopefully become a better amusement park operator, if that makes sense.
It was much better for me, too, because I really didn't like managing people. And Robbie was, I always felt like, was a natural. And so it worked out great for me because it took that load off of me.
I think part of the reason, too, my dad has always entrusted me with a lot of responsibility. I think that my dad's relationship with my grandfather and my relationship with my dad are very similar in a good way compared to other relationships between fathers and son that I have seen. For example, this would make sense to you. I know lots of people who are my peers who own family amusement parks all over the world. Okay? You cannot imagine some of the discourse and fighting there is between the generations over stupid stuff like money.
Mm-hmm.
and power and things like that. And we were never that way. And my dad and my grandfather were never that way. And, you know, since it's almost Father's Day, I mean, I think it's important to point that out. That's one of the, for me, I think it's one of the greatest blessings I have. And I think my dad would echo that with his father. And I hope I pass that on to my two sons, too. That it's okay to have disagreements, but it needs to be about the really important stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
Not things like power and money and all of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you ever consider doing anything besides bells when you were growing up?
I'm going to answer that question, but before I do, I want you to ask him.
Did you ever consider doing anything besides bells?
Oh, yeah. In the beginning, it was really a small operation. And I toyed with the idea of being a lawyer because my grandfather was a lawyer.
Yeah.
But after I graduated from TU, I went to TU Law School for one semester. And I saw
right... What year, Daddy? 63, 64?
No, yeah, this would be, I graduated in 63, so it was the fall of 64
okay.
law class. And I saw right away, I had such arguments about everything about the way the law was versus what I envisioned it was supposed to be. And I don't think I would have made a good lawyer. Certainly some of my friends became successful lawyers, but it was not for me.
But there's an important reason why you were contemplating that decision. The park, it wasn't a given that the park was going to be big enough
right.
to support my grandparents, who at that time are not old people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're still young people.
Yeah.
And then my father and my mother, who are just getting ready to start a family. You know, it's before Zingo.
Right. Yeah.
So. Yeah, it was. Yeah, the first 4 or 5 years of our marriage was pretty tough. I didn't make much money at all. The park was real small. We were successful, but we were constantly adding new stuff. We put all of our extra money into the equipment.
So just reinvesting instead of putting it in your pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but I just expected more from life than that rat race I was in. So I even toyed with the idea, well, I guess I could become a teacher. Well, I would never be any good at that either, I think. I can't imagine me as a teacher. I mean, I could teach, but not in a regimented school yeah. setting.
So you go with the family business, you stick it out, and it turns into a success.
Oh, yeah, I love the business. Oh,
right.
My gosh, it's so exciting. I mean, and I'm really well suited for that because I have, honestly speaking, I have a very inventive mind. In fact, I'm borderline scatterbrained. I go off on all sorts of tangents, as you probably have noticed in talking here.
But it sounds like something you got from your dad, because for him to be the inventor type person he was, didn't he have to have kind of that same type of brain?
Yes, I'm very much like my dad in that respect. My Robbie is more like my wife.
Okay.
A little bit more analytical, plus more in tune to the way people are. Mm-hmm. I become so wrapped up in what I'm doing that I become oblivious to what other people are occupied with.
Yeah. So, Robbie, did you ever consider getting out of the family business?
And that was a much easier decision for me, because by the time I came along, the park was big, relatively speaking. My father knew very difficult financial times before the park and during its infancy and, you know, the first several years of its operation, okay? I never knew that until, until people took our business away from us. Yeah. And then I got hit in the face with it. So I had a different experience as far as that goes. But no, I was infatuated with the park from as far back as I can remember. And not just the fact that, yeah, it is cool when your daddy owns the biggest playground in the state. That's cool, yeah, and all the kids like you and all that stuff. And that part's great. But I loved how the whole thing functioned. I would love to hang out in the maintenance shop. Now, my mother wouldn't like it because you got a bunch of dudes down there, and needless to say, their language is a little colorful and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I loved hanging around with those guys and listening to what they say, you know, and learning from them, because I just find them fascinating.
Yeah.
And then dealing with the public, which is a joy and a very difficult thing all wrapped up into one, okay? Mm-hmm. Dealing with employees, most of whom are teenagers. The Lord Almighty has not made a teenager that wasn't a pain in the neck, including myself. I mean, when we're teenagers, we're all difficult, right, man. That's just how we are.
Trying to figure some stuff out in the world.
Exactly right, man. Yeah, you bet. And
some people are perpetual teens.
That is true.
That's true, too.
They never grow out of it. But I never had any inclination to do anything else, ever. No.
What was your favorite ride as a kid? Since you were around, I'm sure you got to ride some of the stuff occasionally. You weren't just working on it.
No. I rode rides all the time.
Yeah, what was your favorite ones?
I always loved riding Zingo. I won't say that I rode Zingo every single day of the year that it was open, but more days than not. As I got older, I would ride the rides just to listen to the equipment, to feel the equipment. There's a gazillion ways to inspect and maintain an amusement ride, and riding it is one of them, okay? And so, but I always loved the Himalaya, but I think Phantasmagoria was a great dark ride for its time. It was fantastic.
I will never forget that bus horn coming
around.
Everybody
remembers. Yeah, everybody remembers the bus. Yeah.
And the skeletons that would take over.
Yeah. Yes. I think our log ride was one of the best log rides ever built. It was a great log ride. Of course, Wildcat was a great coaster. The Mad Mouse, a lot of people will remember the Mad Mouse from the old days. That was a thrilling, fun ride. We used to have this thing, the crazy thing called the flying cages, okay? And so it's just a gigantic metal box, basically, all right? And you get in it, and you swing, okay?
Shifting your weight.
You got to shift your weight back and forth.
Yeah.
And this is a worker, man. And, I mean, and eventually you could go all the way around.
Like this.
I can remember, of course, because we never had to pay for it, we could ride it as many times as we wanted. I can remember me and my buddies, oh, man, we'd make a deal out of it. We'd get towels so that we could put them on the bar so it wouldn't hurt our hands. We'd sit in there, we'd ride that dadgum thing for hours and hours and hours, you know. So
wow.
I love all amusement rides. I guess the Himalaya is probably my favorite personally, but I loved them all.
Did the Himalaya always have the music component to it?
Yes.
From the beginning?
Yeah, that's how they're all built.
Okay. Yeah. And so what year was the Himalaya installed?
1973.
Yeah.
So did it originally have, like, record drop?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we played 45s.
Yeah.
If you can imagine that. Okay, right. So you've got to run this ride. You've got roughly 50 to 75 people on it if it's full boat. And you got to change a record every 2.5-3 minutes. So we started with 45s, and then we went to 45s and albums.
Wow.
Okay, and so, and obviously you didn't play an album all the way through. You'd usually just play one cut of an album. So you got to get the needle over there, and you got all this other crap going on. And then when CDs came along, that made life a lot easier, you know.
Now, and Bob has been laughing this whole time. Like, there is something that he knows, remembers.
Oh, well, sure. Okay. I'll let him give you some Himalaya stories.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk about the Himalaya. When I would run the Himalaya, I would have a huge top hat. It was a big woolly thing. And I used to smoke cigars. And I had this big, long cigar. A cigar is about 7 or 8 inches long. Big cigar. And I would speak, supposedly, with a German or a Swiss accent. At least it convinced all these naive teenagers that I was Swiss. They thought I was from Bern, Switzerland. And I would say, do you want to go faster now?
Yes.
Ooh la la, ay, ay, ay. The Himalaya.
Okay. See, part of it, Tim, is in 73 when they didn't want to let teenagers run this thing, okay? Yeah. And so you've got people like as important as my father. I can remember our head of maintenance, a guy named Ed Miles. He would run the thing because they wouldn't turn loose of this microphone, the ability to play music, and watch all these people just 17 and 18-year-old kids. So you always had the big guys running it there for a while.
Well, and these people thought I was one of the, you know, the in crowd or something like that because I was so goofy. But anyway, you know, this guy with a big top hat, you know, like, you imagine Leon Russell with a big cigar. Well, I mean, without the hair anyway. But anyway, it was so silly. But I remember sometimes they would throw marijuana cigarettes at me in the booth.
We call that a joint, Daddy.
A joint, yeah, okay.
A joint. Get hip with it. That's 1980 lingo, I think.
Well,
wait a minute. What do you call it now, a blunt?
I mean, I...
Yeah, something like that. I'm asking Tim like he's an expert.
they call it an essential business now.
That's what they call it. Oh, well said.
Tulsa Talks listeners, if you own a business, this is for you. The Tulsa Regional Chamber wants to be your partner in prosperity. With a membership in the Tulsa Regional Chamber, you will be connected to a growing network of 2,000 business owners throughout Northeast Oklahoma. Your company will join the largest business-to-business community in the Tulsa area. At more than 100 chamber events a year, your company can build relationships with potential clients, promote your brand, and give back to the community we all love. Through the chamber, you can connect to Visit Tulsa, the Tulsa Convention and Visitors Bureau, as well as the Tulsa Sports Commission and their programs and events. Whether you are interested in legislative advocacy efforts, becoming a member of Tulsa's Young Professionals, or supporting diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts through Mosaic, membership in the Tulsa Regional Chamber will help you impact our community and build your business in meaningful ways. For more information on how the Chamber can partner with you, visit TulsaChamber.com.
You having all this fun, apparently, as you're growing up there at the park and everything, and then you eventually take it over.
Yeah.
How hard was it for you to hand over the reins, or were you ready to do it? Were you ready to just say, take it over?
Was I ever ready? My main, like I said earlier, my main enjoyment was fabricating things. You know, I grew up welding and cutting, you know, putting things together, fixing things. And so I could just putz around the shop. And So it was a great thing for me. I still worked hard, and in fact, I almost got what's the mild form? Is it heat? Not heat stroke, but heat
exhaustion.
Yeah, heat exhaustion.
Yeah,
happened to me twice just because I was all wrapped up in the project. And when you get weather like what we've had recently in the, mm-hmm. in the heat and everything, you can get dehydrated really fast. And that happened to me twice. And at that time, I was like in my, early 60s. And, just because, but I wasn't even fiddling with running the park. I mean, the day-to-day operation. Of course, strategically, I was always very involved. Mm-hmm. And you have to have that strategic outlook always there.
I think that also goes back to, you know, how we were talking about money and not fighting about money, not fighting right. about power. Okay, so to answer your question, I'll give you some chronological stuff. But okay, so by the time, 1987 rolls around, 1988, so I'm 20. In 1988, I'm 23. I'm the general manager of the park. Okay, so that means the only people that I answer to, technically, would be my parents. My dad was the president. My mother was the vice president. Mm-hmm. We put these titles in there for other people.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, channels, whoever wants to do an interview, well, you got to give a title.
Yeah.
Okay. The titles never meant anything to our family, okay, because this was such a team effort. So from a title standpoint, by 87, I was in charge of all the operation. And by 94, I was the president of the corporation. Okay? But that was just for other people. The way we work is really pretty simple. My dad and I trusted each other. And when we had issues, we would talk about them. And maybe it's just God's gift to us, but we very rarely disagreed. When we did disagree, it was very amicably solved. We attack things from two different perspectives, let's say, and so that's what makes us a good team. I think even though my grandfather and my dad were also very similar people, because my dad and I are very similar people, especially in our mannerisms. You know, we walk into a room, people go, oh, gee, many Christmas, here come the bellboys. Because we're loud and crazy and all that kind of stuff. But we also have some very definite differences. And I think the team of Robert Sr., my grandfather, and my dad was great. And I think the team of my dad and myself is great, because we complement each other. We would have differences of opinion, but again, when you own your own family business, especially one that is as, let's say, crazy as running an amusement park, you can't let little things bother you.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to think big picture. You've got to be open to discussion. That's a lesson that he taught me that's very valuable to me, is my dad always would listen. Doesn't necessarily mean he agreed, but he would always listen to his key people. And as an older person now, I always try to do that myself. Listen to the people around you, because you never know what nugget of gold they've got in their head. And you get that thing, and it can propel you whatever way you want.
Yeah, we haven't said enough about my dad. My dad was so driven on everything he did. It was almost everything was a superhuman effort, and he never was satisfied with things. And it was this drive that actually, I think, caused him to contact cancer. He just worked himself to death. And it's when we were building the log ride back in '75. And he became sick. He got dehydrated, got a bladder infection, which led to bladder cancer. And then 5 years later, in 1980, February of 80, he died from all the complications of the different cancer. You metastasize, you know, went everywhere. And that was a really hard time because he he was only 60 years old when he died, or 61, pardon me.
Yes.
He was only 61 years old when he died. And I thought about how healthy he was outside of the cancer. But it's something that when Robbie was talking just now, it reminded me about, you know, how really short life is. And that's when I started having these regrets that I had not spent enough time in a leisure way. Well, when there's time for leisure running an amusement park, it's really time that you need to be at work. And so that kind of gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of took our little vacations in the winter. And we ended up doing some of that. But it was...
And we had great vacations.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've traveled all over the world. As a child, yeah. I was able to travel all over the world because of my parents and the work that they did.
And you enjoyed your childhood from all accounts.
My childhood was heaven.
Yeah.
It was heaven on earth.
Yeah.
So even though you have these guilts about not spending enough time going to the lake and stuff like that, to hear him say that it was heaven, does that make you feel a little better?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the deal is, my kids, you know, they just been wonderful, and I've enjoyed them immensely, and I respect them. My dad respected me. I respect Robbie and his two younger siblings, and we get along just fine. The one thing that we have left out a little bit. Robbie alluded to it, the teamwork aspect mm-hmm. of running. You feed off each other. And the different personalities are essential to it. My dad and I were very similar, but my wife, who came into the business in 1971, we'd been married for like, Sally and I had been married for like... 8 years at that time. And she'd been a mother to our three kids, and that was a full-time job. But at that time, we needed her in the business. And she became such an asset because she brought this different perspective. And it kind of kept Robbie and I, these two crazy guys, in tow, you know, because, you know, we go off, brainstorming on different things, you know, it leads no telling where it leads. But you need that, but you've got to have a practical influence on that too, to kind of a throttle, let's call it. You need to ease up on the throttle sometimes, and that's why I was so fortunate that I was married to the gal that I was married to, and we've been married for 57 years.
Wow, Sally's congratulations.
Yeah. And she's been a tremendous asset to our business.
Well, and, you know, I think also, Tim, another thing, speaking of, you know, the father-son deal, losing my grandfather at such a young age, that makes him a whopping 40 years old.
Yeah.
Okay, and the park is a demanding business. And I'm 15 when the old man dies. When I say old man, everybody in Radio Land needs to understand that is a term of endearment.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what he liked to be called, and we called my grandmother, by the way, the old lady. And if Mom Bell, the old lady, if she really loved you, then you could call her the old lady. That's another reason why I have such respect for my dad, because when I was 40, the park was still open. Okay, we got shut down in 2006 was our last year, so I would have been 41. Okay? Yeah. And I can't imagine how, let's say that the park would have continued to operate. I can't imagine how difficult it would have been for me if I would have lost my dad when I was 40 and trying to run the park. Even with my mother, who, an incredible asset in a gazillion ways, but as far as running the amusement park, mm-hmm. I mean, super important, her job, what she did, okay? But even with my mom there by my side, it would have been very, very tough. Very, very tough. That's why every day you got your daddy or you got your son, it's a good day. Yep. You know, yeah. It's a real good day.
For sure.
Yeah.
So you guys do around, what was it, 91, you put in, was it the Chili Pepper Plunge?
Yes. Good memory, my man. It was. We opened. Yeah. Now we opened the old Slippery Water Slide. In fact, the old slip. Do you know about the old Slippery Water Slide?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah.
1980.
Yeah. Oh yeah. In fact, the old Slippery Water Slide was the first ride that was completed without my grandfather being alive.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the first one that my dad did that opened without my grandfather there, and that was in 1980. It was a super huge success. And then we shut it down after the water park craze throughout the United States happened, and Big Splash and all that nonsense down there. So in 1991, yes, that's when we converted the old Slippery Water Slide, which was a three-flume water slide, into a two-flume, what we call in our business, a wet, dry ride. Mm-hmm. Did you ever ride it?
Oh, well, obviously.
Yeah, I remember. Okay.
our baseball team, I grew up in Claremore, and our baseball team, okay, and stuff, it was always functions. And I think, was it orange and green?
No, there were yellow and blue.
Yellow and blue. Okay,
two
so
tubes.
I flipped it in my head.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But I do not remember bad. Two tubes. And yeah. Yeah. You rode like, did you ride like a mat or
a
something?
Raft.
A raft, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, yeah. We had a lot of trees that were involved. That's where you get the green.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a really yellow flume. So
yeah, it was. It kind of glowed with the sunlight.
Sure, the orange he's thinking of is all the supports for the turnpike, which is right next door to the car ride. Yeah, it was all painted orange.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
So you run this park together. It sounds like you don't ever really retire.
No.
From the place. You were there the entire duration of it.
Yeah, I liked the maintenance end of it. You know, I just liked all the machinery. I'm still fascinated by machinery, even right now at 80 years old. I work for a big construction company that builds highways and bridges, and Sherwood Construction, and it's exciting. I work mostly out of the shop, and I'm around all this big, huge bulldozers and scrapers and track hoes and all this stuff.
Wow.
I mean, it's really fascinating.
So you guys run this park successfully. I mean, tons of success. We talked about the addition of some rides along the way and everything. And then we get into the 2000s, and the park's had bumps and bruises along the way that comes with running a park for 50 years, I assume. But when you're around 40 at the time, it comes time for the park to close, and it's a sensitive subject, I know. And Bob, you had talked about how you'd lost your dad when you were 40, and you had to keep running the park. But this time you guys together dealt with another setback when Robbie was 40,
right.
41,
right.
In that range. So this life passion for both of you, I mean, you were a kid that grew up with the park. You were born into it,
right?
And you ran it. Suddenly, that's over. You know, in 2006, when the park closes, how did you guys handle that together? And did it make you stronger, you think, like having to go through that?
Yeah, I think if that adversity is one of the things that God gives us to make us stronger people. It's just a question of whether or not we take advantage of it. And sometimes that adversity can be very overwhelming. To take it to an extreme, let's say the loss of a loved one or something like that. And then probably the next worst thing is what happened to us. You know, someone taking your livelihood, that generations of your family have worked and strived and blood, sweat, and tears been poured into to keep it going. I think, sure, it made my dad and I's relationship stronger. It made it different. We don't ever quit. Okay? We don't quit at anything we do. My grandparents never did. My parents never will, and I never will. And that's why we, as long as we are both on this earth, will continue to push and strive to reopen Bell's against whatever odds are thrown our way. That's what I think.
Yeah, I'd say ditto to that. The adversity thing was really good in the aspect that it helps me more to, me personally, to identify with the people that have been affected by this coronavirus. They lost their businesses, some of them forever. Some of them, it's just so hard to come back. Ours is such a case as that, because it requires so much capital to start a business of any size. With the amusement park, I mean, we're talking about an amusement park that was probably valued just in the machinery and everything anywhere from $10 to $15 million. If you lose it all at once, and it's not by some arson or something, it's we actually dismantled as much of it as we could, trying to preserve as we went down with a limited time frame to do it in. And that was very hard. But the other thing that happened from it, we had a small group of friends that came in strictly on a volunteer basis and helped us out. You know, you really know where your friends are when everything falls apart, and they're there to help you.
And they don't. There's no benefit for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No benefit for them. They, and some of them were past employees. Some of them were independent contractors of ours. And there were so many of them, I'm embarrassed. I start naming them, and then I know I'm going to forget a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, the list is almost endless.
Yeah, it just...
And it still continues to this day.
Yeah, they're still helping.
I mean, my dad got a job. This is a guy who ran a multi-million dollar a year business, okay? And got a job because of my best friend, the man that he works for. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of many examples. People to this day still help us. And that's another thing, too. Part of the reason why Bell's is going to come back you've probably seen over the last, let's say, 6-8 months, the insanity on social media with mm-hmm. regard to Bell's. Okay. Bell's will come back because of all these people that have helped my dad and I and our family. Bell's will come back because of my dad and I's tenacity and our hard work and all of the team members, and there's a bunch of them that underneath us that will make that happen. But the most important reason Bell's will come back is because of the customers. They are a constant, they are the people that shovel coal into the fire. It's what keeps us going and wanting and striving and working as hard as we possibly can to make it go. You know, he brought up something, my dad just brought up something very interesting about, you know, the people that have lost their businesses with COVID and then possibly forever and restarting their business. I tell people, I think at least what my definition of the American dream is gone. And I'll tell you why. You cannot repeat the story that we just told you. And I'll give you a good example. I could build a train, okay? Mm-hmm. So we take a train, we start putting it around a house.
your house, my house, his house, that thing's never going to get open, right? There's too many laws, there's too many rules, there's too many regulations. The neighbors would go ballistic, you know, not in my backyard. You know, everything has been so restricted, it makes starting any business, regardless of its difficulty or simplicity, almost impossible. I mean, it's literally a miracle to get any business of any size going. What makes it really tough is when you have a business with, let's say, a big physical footprint. That brings on a whole bunch of different problems. That's what an amusement park is, mm-hmm. big physical footprint. When it's unique, an amusement park is unique. There's only one in this entire state right now.
Seasonal.
The seasonal aspect of it, oh, man. You know, we're not in South Florida, which is fine with me. Mm-hmm. Okay, I love Oklahoma. But there's lots of times you can't run the amusement park just because of the weather. So, anyway, I didn't mean to get off on that.
Well, yeah, you're
there.
Good though. But I mean, but you're right. But you, for the last 14 years,
yes.
have continued to talk about reopening. I mean, as soon
it's
as it
stopped.
Closed, yeah, you have been persistent about it.
We've been approached by several different outside communities, and we're very flattered that they were interested in us locating in their community. But from a real practical aspect, it's driven by population.
Mm-hmm.
I won't mention any of the communities, but some of them just didn't have the amount of traffic. I mean, the people that live in these outer communities might come to Tulsa, but to get the Tulsans to go to faraway places is a whole nother marketing problem.
Yeah.
And it takes a while. Bell started out very gradually. We started out with a ride around our house. Then we had three rides at the driving range across from the fairgrounds. Then we had the seven kiddie rides in 1951. Then we had the bumper cars in 1954, the Mad Mouse in 1960, Tilt-A-Whirl 1957. All these things built up very gradually. Well, people want bells to be the big bells. They don't know about the little bells. Well, if they're 80, 90 years old, they might know about it. But, and it's their expectations. And we need to cater to those expectations. Yep. And so it requires a great deal of capital to begin with. But we know the business. We know what happens when you go from a nice size amusement park, and then all of a sudden, in 1 year, you put up a roller coaster and that existing park doubles in revenue. Nothing's changed. I'll give you an example of that is Dollywood. Dollywood was an existing amusement park in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yeah.
And that the Hershen family owned. Dolly says she wants to put in an amusement park, and they said, Dolly, why don't you come in with us? We'll rename our park Dollywood. Boom, overnight. It's a tremendous success because Dolly was there. And it's that expectation that you have to cater to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they expect. And that's what we're going to do. The next one, we're going to go in just as hard and heavy as we can. But we know we have got to deliver on the big, and we will.
So you're in this month's issue of Tulsa People.
Yeah.
We show the picture of the Phantasmagoria, and then we show a picture uh-huh. of Robbie holding renderings.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you're pushing forward far enough that you have renderings that shows some sort of location somewhere that you know that you're not sharing. But,
correct.
But it seems like you're kind of close to where you want to be.
Well, let me put it this way. I think this is the closest that we've been in this entire 14-year journey that we've been on to try and get it back. I don't think we're looking at a very long time period from when the world is going to know what we're going to do and where it's going to be.
So you're not going to tell us now?
Can't. No, I wish I could.
I wish you could too.
We're both dying to tell people,
yeah.
And we're dying to get on you know, bulldozers and start turning dirt too. But you've just got to
unfortunately, there are certain ways you have to do things.
Yeah.
And we have to keep things quiet right this second. But we are counting the days.
It's a poker game.
It is a poker game, which I can't stand.
I can't stand it either. You got to hold those cards close to the vest.
I like playing poker. I just don't like playing poker with real life. that part stinks.
You just want to stick to amusement park,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
What would it mean to you guys, you think, to reopen Bell's together, to be there that day where you cut the ribbon, you start up the lights and the clinking sounds and everything that comes with an amusement park? What would that mean to you two to do it together?
It'd be the world to me, because I've never thought of it any other way. For me personally, I can't imagine anything more bittersweet than doing it without my dad.
Yeah. Well, the deal is, it better happen soon. You know, like a commercial, that gal in the back of the car said, you know, I'm 80 years old or whatever. Yeah. You know? We better get it done pretty quick.
Yeah. Part of another thing that's interesting too, Tim, is part of the delay, people just don't understand how expensive this stuff is.
Right.
And what it takes to make one of these things happen. A lot of the people, public, you know, municipalities and then private landowners, let's say, and such, they like to talk about it until you start getting down to the brass tacks and you realize the immense amount of work and expense that is involved in doing a thing like that. And that also has been part of the delay. You know, you'll spend months and months and months at a location or a municipality or with a private owner. And even though you convey these things, it takes a while for it to really set in. And then when it finally does, they all go, whoa, okay. We didn't realize it would be that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you may have been telling them that all along.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's been a long 14 years that I'm hoping is coming to a close real quick.
Yep.
Now, over that 14 years, were you able to catch up as father and son and enjoy the time together without the bells and whistles? And,
well, yeah. I mean,
we're together all the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
The deal is, I've been working with Sherwood Construction for 12 of those years.
Yeah.
And I started out, you know, driving a dump truck, and I drove all sorts of trucks. And now I just mainly deliver parts and papers. That's right. But I'm all involved in something that's just as exciting as the amusement park in its own way. And I love the construction business. I don't know if you've been out to see what we're doing out there on the Gilcrease Expressway, but it's really mm-hmm. exciting. It's going to open up that end of Tulsa, and that's so exciting. It's something we've needed for a long time, but it requires so much money. You got to spend money to make money.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I regret about the park is that we never got credit for what we did for the community. We employed approximately 10,000 teenagers over those years. We paid the fairgrounds over $13 million in rent for that 10 acres of land that they converted into a
parking lot. Yeah.
Okay. We spent about 120% of 13 million, right around 15 million.
Yeah.
For employees' wages. Our biggest expense were the wages that we paid our employees. Now, the Bells didn't come up with that money. That money was paid for by our customers.
Mm-hmm.
Our customers built Bell's Amusement Park.
Correct.
And that's why there's such an affinity for that park. They had the smiles, but they put their money in that park. They didn't realize it at the time what they were building when they paid 9 cents for a ride or 75 cents for a roller coaster ride or whatever the pay one price was. But, I mean, all that was a tremendous economic boon to the fairgrounds until the people of Tulsa County voted for those taxes, namely for to fix the county tax. Before that time, the fairgrounds was self-sufficient. They weren't supported by sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
After they were supported by sales tax, they didn't need bells any longer at the fairgrounds. If you extrapolate the 10 acres that we used and you put that to the 240 acres of the entire fairgrounds, do you think that other 230 acres produced the kind of revenue that we did? If it did, what happened to it? The fairgrounds had no expenses involved in Bell's Amusement Park.
Yeah.
It was money for dirt. Yeah. And that's one of the things that was, one of the stories that was not told. The over $13 million that we paid in rent, the over $15 million that we paid in wages, the attractions that people not only came to see Bell's, but they came to see the rest of Tulsa. I had people talk to me, like a friend of mine who lived in Okemah, you know, down south of here.
Mm-hmm.
The event for him when he was in school was they get on the school bus and they would come up and they get to see Bell's in the spring. Or maybe in your case.
Yeah.
The kids from Claremore came mm-hmm. to Bell's.
Oh, wow. For sure. I mean, I can tell you that we never went to Disney World. My family didn't have the money. So for us, it was like, we went to Bell's. So I can still, like we were talking earlier about some of my favorite rides back then. But like, I can remember the tight curls of the Wildcat and the Joker face at the Zingo. Sure. If you'd stand in line, you know, the go-karts on the south end. Mm-hmm. Like I can still vividly remember because it was so important to me. And it was always full of people. You know, it was still my favorite part when the fair came to town. You know, it was still hang out in the Bell's area. Get your mega ride pass, you know, everything. Well, but
let me spin what he just said for just a minute.
Yeah.
Now let's take what's going to happen now. I said this in the article. Mm-hmm. He and I are not going to know how to behave when we open this new park.
I won't know how to behave when we open this new park.
We're going to feel like we've been let out of jail.
I guarantee you one thing. I'm going to have a hanky in my pocket.
Yeah.
Good. I tell you what, tears come to my eyes right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing a pretty good job of hiding it.
Yeah, me too.
But I've got anticipation and sentimental feelings because my blood and guts are out there. I'll show you some scars.
Yeah.
You got one right here. I mean, you can see it.
Right above your eyebrow.
Right above my eyebrow, yeah. That's where I was kissed by a Ferris wheel.
Okay.
But I was taking it apart, so maybe I deserved it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we're going to be able to do things that we could never do because we're going to have our own spot, and we're going to put together a park that's going to blow everybody away. It's going to be incredible.
Well, judging from all of the love you get on social media mm-hmm. and mixed in with a little bit of the criticism you guys get for not doing it fast enough,
sure.
or, you know, which is going to come because people really want it.
No, and they now, want you it know, back, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I know you guys are hearing it, you know, from the critics that, oh, you're just selling more T-shirts and stuff and, you know, everything. And you got to make money to build a park.
Sure.
Unless someone's going to, I mean, maybe if Elon Musk comes to Tulsa with Tesla,
yes,
maybe he'll throw in an extra $500 million into an amusement park.
Right.
Let's just dream big, right?
Yeah, I tell you what's funny. You think about with Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Go back 20 years ago. This guy's going to make an electric car. He's going to finance this trip to the moon.
Yeah.
You know? No way. Come on.
Yeah. He did it.
I mean, and that's that entrepreneurial spirit. And we're going to start discovering if you just let the people do their thing, they'll make it happen. They'll make it happen. Just get out of the people's way.
So if Elon Musk can help send man to moon, the Bells family can reopen an amusement park in Tulsa. That's what I hear.
I love it.
All right. Well, I appreciate you both coming on here and sharing your story. I mean, it is an important part of Tulsa history.
Thank you.
For, you know, over 50 years, you entertained kids and you made their summers, you know, so much better. And I mean, as you pointed out, you created a major revenue stream for the county that I'm sure a lot of people wish we still had that money coming into the bank, especially at a time where we are now. So I'm pulling for you guys, and I want to be one of the first in line to ride whatever the, you know, if it's Zingo 2, if it's Zingo, Mega Zingo, whatever it is, I want to be one of the first in line to ride it because I want to bring back those memories just like you guys.
We'll save you a seat, buddy.
Awesome. All right. So I appreciate so much. Thank you for coming on here to talk.
We both, we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.